First off, though, the first interview, the first cab off the rank this week, is about Antarctica. And I will invite you to think of Antarctica. And when you think of Antarctica, think of a colour. How many of you thought of the colour white? Well, I would. But my first guest is going to tell you about all the colours living under the water around Antarctica. Even maybe under the sea ice, maybe even under the ice shelves. His name is Dr. Lee Tait. He's a marine biologist with NIWA. And recently he and his colleagues have been able to explore this colourful world for the first time, at least much better than we've ever explored it before, thanks to underwater drones and robots. And Lee's with me now in our Christchurch studio. Kia ora, Lee.
Kia ora, Brian.
Lovely to have you on. When were you last down south, as in further south than Aotearoa?
We got back from the Tangaroa voyage on the 17th of February, so 6 weeks down in the Ross Sea.
And it's not as white as a lot of us folk who've not been there might imagine?
Certainly. Under the water, it is a really dramatic, colourful environment with a huge abundance of life living on the seafloor.
Has there been an explosion in the use of underwater drones, just like we've got so many more drones flying and buzzing around us above ground?
I think we're at the start of that explosion, really. ROVs, or remote-operated vehicles, have been around for quite a while now. But what's kind of changed now is that we've taken some of the things that we've learned from the aerial drones, and we've fitted out our underwater drones with similar systems. And so it's miniaturised a lot of the equipment and made it more accessible.
Is that what the difference is? Because I was thinking, drones, now they've been buzzing around me for a decade at least, maybe even longer. But what is happening in terms of underwater technology that's opening up a new world to you?
One real key aspect of the system that we've been using is fibre cables. We're able to send a lot more data through fibre than we were through traditional copper-type cables. The other thing that we've benefited from is some of the algorithms that aerial drones use to stabilise themselves are actually very useful for underwater drones as well, to essentially stabilise a camera and keep it pointing in the direction that we want it to point.
Because it's one thing to have something that can buzz around in the air or buzz around underwater, but it's no good to you if it can't keep the camera still.
Yeah, that's dead right. Any cinematographer will know that it's, you know, a camera gimbal is a very important part of any sort of filming system, and it's a much more challenging environment under the water.
Amazing. We've got this drone. It can go down to 300 metres, but it can't stay still. Like, the view's a bit fuzzy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's been a lot of developments in the space, and we're really trying hard to make use of it and to help develop it, to get it to be really useful for science, as well as the really cool thing of being able to show people what we're seeing. So it's fantastic to be a part of.
But you mentioned before fibre optic cables as opposed to copper cabling. So now, you know, with a drone in the air, you use radio signals to control it, I mm-hmm. think.
Yep.
Can you do that underwater?
It's massively difficult. Water soaks up a lot of those signals, and so you need really, really powerful wireless instruments to transmit those signals. And the amount of data that you can get back from something that's not tethered is very, very low. So it is a field of that is developing at the moment, but it doesn't get us what we get through a wired system. It's a real constraint on what we do. The other big constraint that we don't have on aerial drones is a GPS signal, which is absolutely critical for a drone to fly the path that you set it on. We can't get that underwater. We have to rely on very, very different systems.
Why can't you get it underwater?
GPS comes from satellites, which have no way of penetrating through the water, basically.
Right, so it's the same problem as a radio control. You can't get a signal down the water.
So we would have to relay that GPS signal from satellites through acoustic sensors on the top of the water that would then act like water satellites, basically. So setting out like an array of beacons on the surface to do exactly what the satellites are doing on land to try to do the same thing at the seafloor. And that type of technology is pretty early stages.
Yeah, it sounds complicated and expensive.
Yeah.
And probably the kind of thing you'd tear your hair out with.
Yes, we've done that a few times.
Yeah, but getting back to fibre optics, so in a way, the big difference for you guys underwater with robots and drones is replacing copper cabling with fibre optic cabling, right?
Yeah, it's certainly one of the aspects that allows us to see in real time very, very high quality imagery, which has been pretty troublesome for a while now. Obviously, it's been improving all the time, but every now and then you get these sort of leaps that allow you to do this. The other aspect about the fibre cable is how thin it is, so how little drag it has in the water when we're using this unit, and how strong it is as well. So a lot of physical and technological developments being made.
So drag in the water, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, the more tether you put out on this sort of unit, the more the water drags on that cable and starts to affect the manoeuvrability of your unit, even if you do your best to stay close to it.
Right, because basically it's now putting a heavy train behind it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Even the thinnest cable, if you've got 500 metres out of it, that's a lot of weight.
Does this mean with fibre optics you can actually get your drones, your robots, your remote-operated cameras, your ROVs, out further from a boat than you could before?
Yeah, I think in what we're doing, we're trying to minimise that distance between the unit and the boat, especially horizontally. We want to be able to get directly vertical below that boat and minimise that amount of cable out and that amount of drag going on.
And even with fibre optics, is it easier to go deeper with a fibre optic cable?
I think we're getting there. I think there's a range of different ways of deploying these things, and probably one of the most novel aspects of what we were doing in Antarctica is we were actually looking at very shallow water, which is really hasn't been done for a big part of that coast. So a deep deployment system, we actually do go to quite industrial equipment. We need it to be heavy, we need it to be strong. But when we're going shallow, then throwing all of that heavy industrial equipment at the problem isn't really the right approach. So we're trying to use the right sort of equipment for the right task, really.
That's interesting. In a way, it's slightly counterintuitive to me, but actually, because it's lighter, you can do more manoeuvrability. You've got more manoeuvrability not too far below the surface, and the signal that's coming back, you're getting more information through the fibre optics.
Yeah, we're driving this unit, so we have to have real time feedback of what we're seeing. So having that really high quality connection between the unit underwater and the surface means that we can react to what we're seeing in real time. If it's really bad currents, then we can drive it into the currents and look at what we want to look at without being pulled away from our subjects, basically. So, yeah, the shallow environment was a good test of the unit.
What have you been discovering?
Probably the highlight for me was seeing really big seaweeds in deep water. So at about 70 to 80 metres, we were seeing very, very big kelp-type seaweeds. And for anything that photosynthesises, they need a lot of light. And the deeper you go in the ocean, the more of that light is absorbed and reflected by the water. So seeing big plants at that sort of depth in an area where there isn't sunlight for half the year was just absolutely phenomenal.
You didn't know they existed?
We knew they existed, and there had been some observations from trawls, so people had pulled up samples from quite deep of these things, but it was always discarded as being it's something that's just fallen off and drifted into deeper water. But this was real data of plants in situ, so very good evidence that some of these photosynthetic organisms may be going a lot deeper than we expect.
What latitude were you coming across this deep water kelp forest?
At about 72 degrees south. So, yeah, a very long way south.
This is the edge of the continent itself?
Yeah, the Ross Sea kind of dips back into the continent towards where Scott Base is. So we're at the very top of the Ross Sea, starting to head south when we observe these kelp forests.
To have such botanical richness at that depth, but at that latitude, because, you know, above ground there's no trees, but yet we've got an underwater forest literally growing here at 70-80 metres down.
It's absolutely stunning. It's really, I personally find it really mind-boggling, and it's so polarising between what you're seeing on the surface and what you're seeing below the water. And it's, until you see it with your own eyes, it's really hard to contemplate. And it's not only those photosynthetic organisms, but just the life on the seafloor in general is really stunning, and it really highlights to me why we need to understand a bit more about these environments and this part of the world that we've really left almost untouched.
Well, kelp forests are a pretty rich place in terms of biodiversity, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're also they provide a really critical mechanism for relieving CO2 from the atmosphere and from the water and storing that in deep ocean sediments. And finding that sort of biomass of photosynthetic organisms and that at that latitude really sort of opens up a whole new realm of research and how those plants are taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing that in the deep sea. And we really know very little about that flow.
And doing this when, as you say, for probably 3 months of the year at least, I'm just doing a real rough off the top of my head kind of calculation as to how long the longest night would be, but what, maybe 3 months of no light at all?
Yeah, and on top of that, they also have to deal with sea ice for a longer period of time. So as you can imagine, ice on the top of the sea will block even more light than just water. So the window of opportunity for these plants is really, really narrow, and seeing them was, you know, such a great highlight.
One of the other things, and we put a link up on our Facebook page to a little Vimeo video that you've done of some of the footage that you've been getting and talking about it, was the Antarctic scallops, which I wasn't expecting. There's a lot of scallops. Is this in the same area, a bit closer to the surface?
This is further south and similar depths. So this was getting almost to 75 degrees south. And we didn't expect to see them either. You know, it was the first time through the whole trip that we had seen any scallops at all, really. So seeing dense beds of them was quite shocking, because we'd seen very specific communities that were somewhat consistent across the whole range. But all of a sudden, we're in these phenomenal scallop beds.
It does make me wonder, I know I've just touched on light deprivation, but how much, where's the energy coming from? Where's the food coming from that's sustaining this rich ecosystem?
That's a very good question. And we were lucky enough to observe basically where the food is coming from. We went from these crystal clear blue waters throughout the beginnings of the voyage. And as we moved into the Ross Sea, we saw phytoplankton blooms that looked like some of the greenest lakes that you'd see in New Zealand. It was thick soup. It was really something else. And as we would lower our cameras to the seafloor, we could see the moment where we'd drop through this layer of phytoplankton. And it was just so dense, it was like a cloud.
Again, did we know much about those blooms? And again, those blooms, they're not something that's been brought on by changes in the environment recently.
The blooms are pretty well understood, because we can see them quite well from space with satellites. They give off a very distinct spectral signature that we can measure. So we knew that they occurred. What we can't see from space is how thick and dense and what they're composed of, really. So a huge part of our voyage was trying to understand those phytoplankton communities, because like I talked about with the seafloor seaweeds, those phytoplankton communities are a critical part of the global carbon cycle, and the fact that we've established the world's largest marine protected area in the Ross Sea, it's potentially one of the most critical areas of the world for helping alleviate some of the climate change that we're driving.
Speaking of climate change, over the years I've spoken pretty much every summer with one of your colleagues at NIWA, Dr. Craig Stevens, who's he and his team have been working on studying the movement of the ice tongue, I think, that comes off the Ross Ice Shelf into the Ross Sea.
That's
and
right.
The currents and sea temperatures and sea salinity around that ice tongue, and how sensitive the and I'm wondering how sensitive the ecosystems that you're looking at might be to changes in water temperature and salinity and currents.
You've hit the nail on the head, and that's really why we're trying to look at some of these benthic, these seafloor communities, because we really think that they're going to be some of those first responders to that global climate change. And Craig Stevens studies on some of the freshwater dynamics and how that's changing the system is really critical to understanding what the biological shifts might be. At the moment, it is very difficult to disentangle because we very rarely get to go down there and see things, and we even more rarely get to go to the same place more than once. So trying to understand how these systems are changing and how some of the physical environment's changing is really critical to understanding how climate change is affecting these environments.
Yeah, you need to go back there more than once.
Mm.
So when are you going back again?
A 2023 voyage is mooted. It's still a little bit up in the air, but we've left. There is some moorings down there at the moment taking very important measurements, and we're going to have to get them back eventually. So it should happen, fingers crossed.
2023, so yeah. Not this coming summer, the summer after?
That's right, yep.
All right. Wouldn't you be itching to get back this coming summer?
There's a possibility that I'm going down more to the southern part of the Ross Sea, based out of Scott Base, so not voyage-based, but land-based. And the workflow is very different from working on a ship. We're working on the sea ice and putting holes in the ice and sending these ROVs below the surface from little camps on the sea ice. So potentially this summer, yeah.
It's been fascinating talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us, Lee.
Thanks, Brian.
That's Dr. Lee Tate from NIWA, a part of a team that has been getting footage of ecosystems around Antarctica that no one really knew existed until they got the technology that allowed them to explore them. This is new drone technology. They're not drones like they are in the air, because you still need some kind of a cable to control them, fiber optic cable. Ironically, it wasn't the really deep water. It was the water not so deep that they were exploring, but still 80 metres below, 70 metres below is still reasonably deep, discovering rich kelp forests off the coast of Antarctica. Amazing. And there's a little video up on our Facebook page that I alluded to that shows some of the work and a little bit of Lee and his colleagues in action.